study.
The room is shrinking.
Okay, we bring the meeting of the Public Safety Policy and Finance meeting to order. And having a quorum here, we'll take roll call vote.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery.
Here.
Gauthier.
Here.
Grimhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Kelly.
Here.
Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald. Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum. Smith.
Hey, members, good morning. Would somebody please move the minutes from our last meeting?
So moved.
Who is that? Here we go. Representative Gauthier moves the minutes from January 26th. Okay. Any additions or corrections? All in favor, approve. Say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, minutes passed. Okay, members, what I'm going to do is present a bill, and I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Woodard and go out amongst him here.
Mr. Chairman, I understand you would like to move your bill.
Yes, I would. Okay. I would like to move House File 141 to be recommended to pass and move to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee.
Chairman Cornish recommends movement of his bill. And is there any discussion? I think we'd like Mr. Diebel, would you explain the bill for us and differences between current law and what we're proposing here?
Mr. Chair and members, there's a summary in your packet that you can follow along with. In Subdivision 1, we're expanding the felony offense of killing or harming a public safety dog. Currently, it's a felony only if you killed the dog. This would create a felony if a suspect or offender caused great bodily harm to a police dog, and that term is defined in statute, and I've reproduced that in the summary in front of you if you want to know what great bodily harm means. Also in Subdivision 1, the bill proposes changing the restitution provision. Currently it's permissive, and its maximum amount is $5,000. The bill would up the amount to $15,000 and presume that a court would impose restitution, and the restitution can be used to treat and care for the injured dog as well as purchase and train a new dog. Subdivision 2 expands the gross misdemeanor offense of harming a public safety dog. Currently, it requires substantial bodily harm, but this proposal would extend that down to demonstrable bodily harm. And again, I've that term, demonstrable bodily harm, is not defined in statute, but it is defined in case law, and I've produced that in the summary as well, and it's a brief definition that simply states that it's harm that can be perceived by someone other than the victim. That's obviously presumes that that term's usually used in when humans are injured as opposed to dogs, but I think it transfers to the use in this case as well. Also in Subdivision 2, there's mandatory restitution for caring for and perhaps the need to replace and train a new dog if a violation of the gross misdemeanor statute, but that amount is capped at $5,000. And then the final change is in the new Subdivision 2A, which is on page 2 of the bill, and that creates a new misdemeanor level offense of harming a police dog. Of assaulting a police dog, and it requires no proof that the dog suffered any injury, demonstrable or otherwise, and that would be a misdemeanor penalty if someone was convicted of that offense.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Chairman, do you have any witnesses or anyone who would like to testify? Opening remarks?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Opening remarks will be brief. You've heard of the description of the bill and its purpose. My interest in this lies naturally because I've been a law enforcement officer for 36 years, but also because I used to have a canine with me, a large German Shepherd, in Northville, Minnesota, where I was a game warden for 22 years. And he rode with me for 13 years and became injured at one point and temporarily out of service. And when the officers came to me with this proposal, naturally I had a great interest because of my love of dogs and especially German Shepherds. However, there are different breeds than canine use naturally. But so with that introduction and the description of the bill you've heard, I'd like to call my testifiers ahead, whichever one wants to start first, and begin with an apology for not getting down here in time to at least meet them before their testimony. So I'll let them proceed however they would like to, with your permission, Mr. Chair.
That sounds good. Thank you. Can you state your name for the record, please?
I'm Chief Rick Mathwick, Roseville Police Department. Just here for, I don't want to take up much of the committee's time at all. We have better speakers in front of me, but I was listed as a testifier. But I'm here more for questions at the end. I'm going to refer to John Jorgensen.
And thank you, Chief. And can you state your name for the record, please?
It's John Jorgensen, Roseville Police Department. This is K-9 Major, my partner for the last 7.5 years. I'd like to thank you for allowing us to be here today to talk about this very important issue. A little bit of background on myself. I've been a police officer for approximately 13.5 years with the city of Roseville. Last 7.5 years as a K-9 officer. K-9 Major's been my only partner when I've been with Roseville Police Department. I'm also an executive board member for the United States Police Canine Association, Region 12, which is here in Minnesota, and I'm here representing them as well today. We're here to support a change in the current canine law. We think this is a very good starting point, but we believe that there's other changes that could be made. I'm going to give you a couple brief synopsises of incidents that I was involved in this year, or excuse me, in 2010 with my canine. In July of 2010, we were called to assist after a motor vehicle pursuit. Suspect crashed the vehicle. It was a stolen vehicle and fled in the city of Maplewood. K-9 Major and I responded. We tracked the suspect to a lake over near County Road B in Edgerton in the city of Maplewood. Once there, K-9 Major was tracking along the shoreline, indicating to me that there was a suspect close by. I released K-9 Major after giving several K-9 warnings asking the suspect to surrender. Without receiving a response, I allowed K-9 Major to try to apprehend the suspect. K-9 Major did locate the suspect along the shoreline in the water. He engaged the suspect by his upper arm. The suspect then purposely waded out into deeper water about 25, 30 feet from shoreline. As my dog was holding onto him, he took hold of his collar and purposely tried to kill my dog. He took him underwater for 5 to 6 seconds in an obvious attempt to drown him. My dog held on and continued fighting. This happened several more times over the next minute. I had to wade into the water and join the fight with my canine because I really felt that he was going to be killed. Eventually, we were able to take the suspect into custody when we got him into shore. Canine Major was okay other than having some water in the ears and being a little tired. And when we were looking at the charging or the crimes that may be applicable, we found that we couldn't charge this individual with any crimes related to the assault and attempted killing of my canine partner, which we were obviously very disappointed in. Statute currently doesn't cover any type of attempted killing of the dog, and without any demonstrable bodily harm, we didn't have any injuries that would make the gross misdemeanor crime applicable. In November 12th of 2010, my partner and I were just off duty, and we received a call to assist Maplewood PD. they had a possible burglary and theft in progress. We responded to the general area. We responded to the general area, spoke to officers, found out that we had a felony crime in progress. K-9 Major was given access to the fenced-in lot in Maplewood where the suspects were seen by other perimeter officers. We were fearful that we would potentially be ambushed, that there were multiple suspects. K-9 Major, again, after given a K-9 warning, was allowed to apprehend any suspects in the area after we didn't receive a response. K-9 Major pretty quickly picked up some fresh scent and was briefly out of my line of sight. It was at about 5 in the morning. It was still dark out. He went up into a woodline area, and I heard him cry out in an obvious manner where he had been assaulted. It took me several minutes to find my partner. I had called him to me. He couldn't come to me. We were finally able to locate him. When I found him, he was covered in blood. I could tell that he was in a great deal of pain, and I could tell that he couldn't use his back legs. His back legs were folded underneath him. I was able to carry my partner out to an area where we could get him to a squad car, and we rushed him to the University of Minnesota Medical Center. And miraculously, they saved him. He was in very bad shape. He had been stabbed 4 times, once in the head, once in the neck, once in the shoulder blades, and one laterally in his mid-back. The wound to his mid-back struck his vertebrae. And to this day, despite hundreds of hours of physical rehabilitation and some amazing work at the University of Minnesota, K-9 Major suffers from incontinence, and he also can't use his hind legs. He's gone under several surgeries, and that individual was charged with attempted felony theft and the gross misdemeanor harming a public safety dog. He's pled guilty to those charges. He'll be sentenced later on in February, I believe February 16th. A plea agreement has been set, but his exact incarceration in terms of probation haven't been released yet until it's finalized. Essentially what this individual did is he killed Roseville's police dog Major. Even though he's sitting here next to me today, and my family and I are very, very glad that he's still with us, he essentially killed him as a police dog. Major will never work as a police dog again. Major's a 9.5-year-old German Shepherd. He's worked approximately 8 years with the city of Roseville, all with me. He's had a very, very strong career. He's been recognized for his achievements on numerous occasions, and as I said, he's our most senior canine in our city. He'll be formally retired next month. Okay. This has had a profound impact not only on me personally and my family, but also the Roseville Police Department, our family there, and agencies that surround us. Not every agency can afford to have a canine program. We oftentimes respond for mutual aid requests to cities like New Brighton, Moundsview, and St. Anthony Police Department in Maplewood. If there's a canine needed, canine handlers will respond. It's been tremendously difficult having my canine career end in one day, and having Major's canine career end the same way. These dogs are bred to do this. His almost the majority of his entire life has been devoted to being a police dog, and we're kind of adjusting to him not being a police dog and not being able to walk around right now. The crime that we're talking about isn't a crime of great frequency, but it's of great consequence. When a dog is injured, when a police service dog is injured and taken out of work, there's a lot that goes into replacing that dog. First, there's no guarantees. The way the budgets and everything goes nowadays, it's difficult to replace canines if they go down. Fortunately, we're going to be able to replace Major, but that's replacing a very seasoned dog with a new dog. There's a lot that gets lost there. A couple statistical things that I wanted to make you aware of is that out of all the states, there's 48 states that have canine assault laws on the books. 33 states have a maximum penalty greater than 2 years. There are 6 states that have a maximum penalty of 10 years, and then there are 5 states that have a maximum penalty between 5 years and 10 years. 17 states have a 5-year maximum penalty. Of the initial 33 states I told you that had a greater than 2-year maximum penalty, that's 68% of the states that have canine laws in the books, and that also includes the federal government. We would like to see a longer penalty, but there are several things that are already before you that we're very happy that are in there, including the mandatory restitution piece of $15,000. Officer Mark Ficadeni from St. Paul PD will talk about that in a little bit. We like that there's a misdemeanor assault statute added in there as well. And it's just important that people understand that what we ask these dogs to do is very remarkable. Without them on the street, there's a lot of people that aren't brought to justice. A lot of times we take that for granted. About 95% of a police dog's work is done with his nose, not with his teeth. They're a locating tool. They're not an attack animal or anything like that. And without these dogs on the street, there's a lot of people that wouldn't be found, wouldn't be caught, and wouldn't be brought to justice. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that that's what these dogs are here for. On top of that, they're tremendous ambassadors for our cities and counties, and they do a great justice for all the departments they serve.
Thank you, Officer Jorgensen.
Thank you.
Thank you, K-9 Major. Are there any questions for the officer? Representative Gauthier.
I can wait after the next.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any else that we need to testify? Thank you, officer.
Yep.
Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chair, Officer Jorgensen.
Yes. Yeah, just a quick question for you.
Absolutely.
If a criminal did something like this to a human being, would the penalty be equal or greater than what we're talking about here?
We're certainly Officer not asking it to be greater. The threshold for great bodily harm is pretty significant. In fact, if Major were able to walk today, even though he's been paralyzed, he had several surgeries, if he was able to walk today, he probably would not meet the threshold for great bodily harm. Now, that being said, his career would still be done as a police dog. And as I said before, this defendant essentially killed Major as a police dog. We would like to see substantial bodily harm, where you're talking about broken bones and things of that nature, be the threshold rather than great bodily harm. And it would be consistent with our human counterparts. We're not asking for anything more, obviously. The definitions as defined by state statute would be the same. We would use the same definitions.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Right, Representative Greenhagen.
Officer Jarrett said, so basically, if I understand you correctly, if similar injuries were done to a human being, the penalty would be higher than the dog?
Correct.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. All
right. Thank you, Officer Jorgensen. Chairman Cornish, you have a next testifier?
Yep.
Officer, if you can state your name for the record, please.
Mark Ficcadenti, Ficcadenti.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Officer Mark Ficcadenti of the St. Paul Police K-9 Unit. I'm a 26-year member of the St. Paul Police Department and a 21-year active handler, where I currently serve as the unit's head trainer. Probably my most labor-intensive and most dutiful responsibility is the acquisition and selection of police service dog candidates, not only for the St. Paul Police Department, but for those agencies that train in our basic 12-week canine handler school as well. I am also responsible for the coordination of training and maintenance training of not only police agencies that train within the St. Paul Police Department, but for those agencies that train from throughout the region as well. The St. Paul Police Canine Unit is a regionally certified United States Police Canine Association training facility. And ladies and gentlemen, if you have a police service dog in your community, the odds are that it's been trained by the St. Paul Police Canine Unit. And what's interesting with regard to what we're talking about with regard to the restitution of police service dog candidates in 2011, the most troubling and labor-intensive part of my job is finding very highly qualified police service dog candidates. Typically, the St. Paul Police Canine Unit was known for scouring dog pounds, scouring rescue organizations for our police service dog candidates. But that resource is no longer available to us, so we are forced to purchase, for the most part, our candidates from overseas. And people ask me, well, why do you have to go overseas to purchase police service dog candidates when I can look in the want ads and find them for $400 or $500? And the reality is, we go overseas to countries like Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and Holland because they are bred specifically to be police service dogs. The dogs that are bred here in the United States are bred for the most part to be show dogs or to be pet quality dogs. And it is a very, very special dog that we need in the police service dog business. For those of you that hunt, it's the same way. It's genetics. It boils down to nothing but genetics. We have an expression that says just because you have a horse doesn't mean it can run in the Kentucky Derby, and that is true. It's motivated by money. Since 2011, it is getting more and more difficult for us to acquire dogs for our basic canine handler school. Currently, the price to replace a police service dog candidate for not only the St. Paul Police Department, for an agency such as Roseville, is $7,500 US, and that is for a 10-month-old German Shepherd dog. And the reason I use the term, ladies and gentlemen, US dollars, it's all based on the euro. So if I purchase a dog today for 3,700 euro, and I forward or wire my money tomorrow, there could be such a price fluctuation depending on what happens with the euro that we really have no way of knowing for sure what the cost of that animal will be. So with regard to that, just because we go overseas, and I've done that, and purchase 10 or 12 or 15 police service dog candidates, does not mean that that dog will graduate through our 12-week basic canine handler school. Because whether we've used donated dogs or whether we've used dogs from overseas, our failure rate with police service dog candidates is still 25%. So the benefit of a $7,500 police dog is if something fails with regard to the training aspect of it, I can send it back to the vendor overseas. However, for me to ship a dog over to the country of Slovakia could easily cost the St. Paul Police Department or the Roseville Police Department $1,500 US. We, as I stated before, ladies and gentlemen, we are a regionally certified training facility, and we've done this for 52 years. We're one of the oldest canine units in the country, established in 1958. We do this as a service. This does not generate revenue for the St. Paul Police Department. For 12-week basic canine handler school, the City of Roseville or other agencies will be charged $2,500. And specialty training, $500. And with regard to specialty training, that means narcotics or bomb detection. But for $3,000, these handlers will undergo a 12-week basic canine handler school and a month-long specialty school. If a private vendor were to provide the same service that we provide, it would easily cost an individual $15,000 plus US. And I can guarantee you they wouldn't get the quality training that the St. Paul Police Canine Unit does provide these officers. The acquisition of dogs, it's time, 12 weeks. People ask me, do I need to send my canine handler to a 12-week school? And my response is, yes, it is truly a pay me now or pay me later business. And when you have a small agency like the Roseville Police Department or others that we train, whether it's one officer from St. Paul or it's one officer from Roseville, not having that officer on the street, it's difficult for the other officers in the police department. So time. How do we put time? If you were to ask me, how much does it cost to replace a police service dog? I can give you the hard numbers with regard to the dog, the training, the equipment, but what I can't put the hard numbers on are what it costs the police department. What would it cost the St. Paul Police Department to retrain me? It would cost the St. Paul Police Department a lot of money to retrain me as a 26-year police officer at a 26-year rate of pay. And that's how pretty much the determination of the replacement of a police service dog is figured into the equation. It's the person that puts the time and effort to it based on the rate of pay according to the pay schedule or the rate structure of that police department. So, and sir, if I may, with regard to your question, with regard to substantial or demonstrable bodily harm, if I may, they have changed the threshold nationwide with regard to the definition of great bodily harm or the injury quotient of great bodily harm or death. Here in Minnesota, it is still forced that in all likelihood will cause death or great bodily harm, but the nation overall has fallen back to the substantial bodily harm threshold as one element of the deadly force statute as well. One thing that I do would like to clarify, though, ladies and gentlemen, and you are right, sir, police service dogs are not police officers. People automatically say, that dog is a police officer, and we hold the status of that dog as we do a human officer. We don't. We do not elevate the life of a dog to that of a human being. That is why we use dogs. However, we had a police dog stabbed 3 times in 2001 while trying to apprehend an individual wanted for a narcotics warrant. It was a screwdriver. The dog suffered 3 deep stab wounds. However, there was not any significant or demonstrable injury to the dog. There were no major organs that were damaged. So according to the evaluation by our vet, it did not fit at that time the substantial or great bodily harm element of that. So therefore, no charges could be filed in that respect. So this, in my opinion, the restitution element of it is as important as the criminal element, because for police departments it is oftentimes more difficult in that respect to deal with than the criminal element of the replacement of a police service dog.
Thank you, Officer Ficadenti, for your testimony. Representative Gautier.
Thank you, Chairman. Just to get back to the $15,000, that doesn't even begin to cover the cost of officers' time. They're out. For example, in Duluth, we lose an officer for 3 months.
Yes, sir.
So $15,000 doesn't even begin to cover the cost, let alone the years of service of Major or other dogs that have been injured.
Yes, sir.
So I'm wondering, Chairman Cornish, if you're amenable to a change of upping that number. And I'm wondering also if you're amenable to substantial versus great. And I don't know if that we can do that or not, but those would be my questions to you.
Chairman Cornish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, I guess I would be amenable to the restitution, because that really wouldn't be a fiscal impact on the local government. But the other one, I think when we change that, I'm really wary. I would have loved to have a more severe penalty, and I told the officers this, but I fear risking the bill as we up a fiscal note. And so I wanted to keep that, you know, balance it off, because it would be a tragedy to lose the bill for the cost. So, but I would be up for an amendment to raise the restitution price. And this has to go to judiciary yet, too.
I guess I would like to amend to $25,000.
And we have a motion to amend. And could you restate the motion, please?
Chairman, I would like to amend House File 141 in restitution, Section B, from $15,000 to $25,000.
All right. Mr. Diebel, can you read that for him?
Mr. Chair and members, the motion would be on page 1, line 18, delete $15,000 and insert $25,000.
Is there any discussion regarding the amendment? Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cornish, what do you think of that amendment?
Chairman Cornish?
It's a good amendment. You know, you always risk the chance of these guys, the reason they're being chased is they're not a very high-quality person a lot of times, and they don't have much money, but in the case that we are able to get back restitution, even in monthly installments, I would much prefer a higher figure. So I approve of that figure, yeah.
Any further discussion on the motion? Okay, we'll move to a vote. And we'll do a voice vote. Roll call vote. Okay, we'll do a roll call vote.
But you don't have to.
No? Okay, we will do a voice vote. Okay, all those in favor of the motion to amend, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion is approved.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Of the maker of that motion and of the author, what about line 2.5 addressing the gross misdemeanor portion of the restitution?
Representative Gautier.
I'd be amenable to upping that to 10.
in the spirit of bipartisanship. Mr. Diebel, what say you on how that would read?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be on page 2, line 6, delete 5,000 and insert 10,000.
Mr. Chairman, of the author, I was only asking a question. I wasn't making a motion. However, so moved on that amendment.
Okay. Chairman Cornish.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. So now the motion has actually been made to amend the bill. And is there any discussion on this motion? Hearing no discussion, we will have a voice vote. All those in favor of amending the bill, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion is carried. Any further discussion? Representative Mulery.
You had a question for this officer?
Somebody. This is, and I just hadn't realized we did restitution on these things. So it's just a question. Do we do that for, I assume this goes to the city that paid it or whatever, the restitution.
Yes, sir.
Do we do that for police officers? And I know some friends of mine might not be trainable that are officers, but no, the cities spend a huge amount of money on training officers. Do we?
Yes,
I have no idea. Do we have restitution when somebody harms one that can no longer work for the city? Can the city get restitution?
Sir,
for that, I've never heard of that.
I can speak from my own personal experience with regard to an injury on the job. I certainly cannot speak for a department in 2011, but back in 1985 when I was injured on the job, the department did seek restitution for me personally and for the department professionally as well.
Thanks. I'd never heard of that.
Mm-hmm. I know, Mr. Chair, I also... I've got reimbursed once from a defendant through the judge for ripping my shirt off and cutting me. So it's definitely possible.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cornish, just a question regarding the bill on 1.8. I'm just curious when it says to intentionally and without justification cause of death. Just curious if there's any ambiguity on the judicial side of a judge saying, well, the criminal thought his life was in peril because of a harmful dog. But does that open the gate for a justification for the criminal to cause bodily harm or death to a dog?
Chairman
Cornish? Let the officer address that.
Officer, if you could.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
And just a reminder, the witnesses, please reference your questions through the chair, please.
Okay, I don't know what that means.
Okay.
I apologize.
I just learned it about 3 weeks ago.
We're learning that, too.
I just learned that about 3 weeks ago. So just start your sentence with Mr. Chairman, and
okay,
I will
Mr.
direct
Chairman,
the question and the answer. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, Mr. Thank you. Sir, that's a very good question, and I'm a federally certified expert with regard to canine law and canine deployment, canine use of force, high-risk search and cover. And yes, sir, they do that. They attempt to do that. And one of the interesting things about this statute is people attempt to fight off police service dogs all the time while they're in the act of an apprehension. And there are three elements that one individual will try to protest. But more importantly, and you do, ladies and gentlemen, have use of force experts that will come in and testify that the reason that suspect did what he did is because that dog did this, he did that, and he was protecting himself. There are use of force instructors that will testify that a criminal can use legitimate force to include deadly force upon a police officer who the defendant believes is using excessive force or unethical behavior. So one must define in the criminal's mind, okay, what is his opinion of unethical behavior? In other words, they are legitimizing the use of force against police officers if they deem the force used against them is excessive or unnecessary. So me shooting and killing that police dog is justified based on this. So as a federal, as an expert in police service dogs, it is my job to defend that and articulate that based on my experience as a canine handler, based on my experience as a use and force instructor, based on case law, based on legal update, and based on general practices with regard to the deployment and use of police service dogs. So yes, but we can defend that. Sir.
Thank you. Are there any further questions or any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative McDonald?
Just to follow up. In that scenario, then, is there any justification for a criminal who's being chased for a crime to cause bodily harm or death? Now, one could argue that if it's not in that scenario, if an innocent bystander is being chased by a dog, he could be justified. But if this is a criminal that's broken the law and being chased, is there any justification for him to kill a trained canine dog? And I think that I'm not a lawyer, obviously. Maybe Representative Smith can help in this. But I would think that perhaps it could be written that it says any person intentionally causing death or bodily harm. I would say that opens the gate that I was justified. The dog was going to bite my face off, so I killed him. Well, he's a criminal. He was being chased. He was ordered to stop by the police. He didn't. But I'm not an expert. I'm just asking the question.
Yes, Officer Figuerenti.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to that question, and when people try to debate that issue as well, there's one reason that people kill police dogs. There's one reason that people kill police officers. It's to escape. It's fear of capture. It'd be like the felony murder doctrine, if you're familiar with that. Same thing. You don't go into a store intentionally killing somebody, but if it happens in the course of the felony, they hold you to that account as a premeditated account. So, sir, that would be, in my professional opinion, the way the statutes, if in the scope of a deployment, a legally, ethically justified deployment of a police service dog, that dog is injured, that dog is killed. I think that's prima facie, professionally. Because whether it's unintentional or not, he was warned, federal law mandates, you will stop, police department, stop or I'll send the dog. If they do not, they dictate the actions of the officer, okay? The handler controls the dog. It's handler control. The dog doesn't make the decision. He sends it on a lawful apprehension. Suspect hears the warning. Suspect chooses to ignore the warning, fight the dog. The dog dies. He should be held accountable for that.
Representative McDonald, any follow-up?
No, Mr. Chairman, just that I think it might be a good idea to remove that term, justified, but I made my case.
Yes, sir. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to belabor this, but in St. Paul, we're very acutely sensitive to this issue because we've lost officers, canine officers.
Yes, sir, we have.
Officers in recent memory, and our entire city was in a lot of pain over that. But I do want us to be very careful in the rhetoric that we throw around here. A criminal versus a suspect, they're two different nouns. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that a person is a criminal once they're adjudicated through our system. And it doesn't go, I think, to the language of the bill, and it certainly doesn't counter the officer's testimony here at all. And I know that, officer, you used the word suspect, and I believe you're very deliberate about that. But I think it goes to sort of the psychology of the committee and the legislature that I think we need to be very deliberate and very careful about justifying whatever policy we come forward here and be able to balance those policies off with the fact that individuals, unless they're past criminal, are not criminals until they've been adjudicated by the law. And it's not a major thing, but it, you know, it's, well, actually it is a major thing. I think it speaks to the issue of how, you know, our legal system considers people de facto innocent until they are proven guilty. It is the burden of the state to do that, and properly so in a free society. But at any rate, I'm sorry, officer, I don't want to belabor this, but I do think it's important for us to be very careful. And I actually do have a real quick question for you.
Sure.
So I could see a scenario, and I don't know the relationship between the trainer and the canine.
Yes, sir.
Officer, I suspect that it's a very strong relationship.
Yes, sir.
In other words, that dog is not going to do anything unless you tell it to do. That's kind of what I'm hearing. I'm seeing a scenario where you have a crowd of folks. So now it's a much more complicated situation.
Yes, sir.
You have several people there. You have people who have phobias of dogs.
Yes, sir.
That's a very real, that happens in my family. I love them.
Yes.
I have lots of family members who are afraid of dogs. I could see a scenario where someone in the crowd, out of fear, may lash out at a dog. Talk about this bill in terms of handling, or in terms of how it would apply in a situation like that, and can you actually see a situation like that happening?
Officer Figueroa.
Chairman, if I may just clarify one thing with regard to your suspect criminal comment, people poison police service dogs. They'll toss poison meat in the kennel, and it has nothing to do specifically with any crime in particular. It just could be just a crime against the police. Tainted meat, the dog is dead. We've had instances of that as well. Sir, what a police service dog does falls solely on the handler. We adopt a strict liability policy. If you didn't know, you should have known. So in a situation like that, it is absolutely incumbent upon the handler not to allow anybody. And people, even my own children, like to tease the dog. That's what people do. Kids do that because they like the reaction. So it falls solely on the handler. And the handler has to take responsibility for that. So this would not, in that case, apply to that unless that person were to come out of the crowd, intentionally go for the dog, and attempt to kill or maim that dog. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so, Mr. Chair and officer. So I think part of what I hear, and I suspect if this bill moves on to a Judiciary Committee, that this will be further talked about. But I think kind of what I hear is that in perhaps the rare instance where the trainer, for whatever reason, fails to exercise the incumbent control over the canine officer, it seems to me that would probably be admissible as a defense if that were to happen.
Yes, sir.
Officer Figueroa.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, sir. Any accidental bite or any situation, strict liability. Yes, sir, you're right.
Thank you. And I'd like to pause here for a moment. I recognize that the Chiefs of Police Legislative Committee is here this morning, and I understand you have to leave at 11 o'clock, so I just want to recognize that you're here and thank you for your service. Are there any further discussion on the bill? Any further questions? Okay. Anyone like to testify in opposition to this bill?
See if there's any more in
favor or opposition. We'll start with in favor. Okay. Hearing none, would you like to renew your motion?
I would. Unless there's, if there's no questions, I'd renew my motion to recommend it to pass House File 141 and move to the Judiciary Committee of Policy and Finance.
Okay. Chairman Cornish moves that House File 141 be moved as amended and re-referred to the House Judiciary Committee. We'll do a voice vote. All in favor of this bill, please signify by saying aye.
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 Anyone opposed? The motion carries. All right. let's take a quick 30 seconds here as we wait to introduce the next House file. I understand you have a motion to move House File 151.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 151 to be recommended to pass and go to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee.
Chairman Cornish moves, or has a motion to move House File 151 and refer it to the House Judiciary Committee. Is there any discussion? I'm sorry. First of all, let's have an opening statement from you, Chairman Cornish.
What's that?
An opening statement?
Hmm. Well, first of all, maybe I would like to offer the amendment to get it in the proper form.
Okay.
It's a technical amendment in the title of, I think, Mr. Diebel could explain the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill as introduced in the title states that all predatory offenders would be posted on the Internet. And that's not an accurate description of the bill. And so to clarify what the bill does, this amendment states clearly that it's only to post level 2 and 3 predatory offenders on the Internet as opposed to a larger group of up to 17 or 18,000.
Chairman Cornish, do you have a motion to amend?
Yeah, I would move to amend House File 151 with the A1 amendment.
Okay. Chairman Cornish has a motion to amend House File 151 with Amendment A1. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, we'll have a voice vote. All those in favor of Amendment A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Motion is carried. Chairman Cornish, any further opening statement?
Yes. Mr. Chair and members, this is going to be a little more controversial than the last bill, and I'm not going to try to sensationalize this bill, though I will talk to you in blunt terms about sexual offenders and predatory offenders and past history with it. I'll keep the rhetoric down, try to stay focused on the issue at hand here, even though I feel strongly about this bill with my past experience with the subject matter covered here. Currently, we have 101 offenders, and when I give these statistics, if I'm off a few, I'm Mr. Dene when he testifies later, or Eric from Knudsen from the BCA might correct me some of these, and maybe if I mislabel a little bit, I encourage him to correct me. I'll try to put it to you as straight as I've got the facts and be as close as I can, but currently, I think we have about 101 level 3 sex offenders living within 4 miles of each other in Minneapolis. However, we don't know how many level 2 offenders there are in this area. In your packet, I think that we've included some information. Now, you'll see, that's the information I was talking about will be on the handout called DOC Predatory Offender Information. Now, on level 3, like I say, the DOC, the Department of Corrections, keeps up the website on level 3 offenders, and the BCA keeps a website on non-compliant. What this bill would direct to be done, House File 151, is to put level 2s and level 3s on the DOC website. Now, I don't think they're really too excited about that. I can't predict what they will say in their PowerPoint program, but The reason behind the bill is, it could be a whole lot of philosophical differences among here in the committee, but I consider level two sex offenders to be pretty serious offending folks, and a pretty good chance they'll offend again. And to kind of make this point, if you would pull out of the sheet that talks about the St. Paul plumber accused of child molestation, it's this sheet here that you got copied. A typical case to me in law enforcement is a case like this, where you have somebody coming into a house and perfectly, seemingly harmless, and ends up molesting children. The problem with the level two and the level threes, you know, the more we know about these people, the better. Some people would like to keep level twos off of the website, and they're worried about the scarlet letter, the brand that they'll get. But the problem is a lot of the sex crimes, like you maybe heard me talk in a committee hearing before this, it's not like stealing a bag of tools out of your garage or a spare dryer out of the back of your pickup. This is somebody that could possibly stealing the virtue or the dignity or something of your or son or daughter. So it's a little more important. And when the DOC talks about chances they'll reoffend are low, or recidivism rate is low, to me, in common layman terms, it's a bunch of baloney. That's not what I worry about so much in the fact that these people operate by stealth. In my own relationship in law enforcement over the past 36 years, you don't know about all the crimes. All the crimes have not even reported. And especially after someone first gets caught, he sure isn't going to admit a second offense. And they operate by stealth in their own family, and the friend's family, they go over. It could be any one of a number of things. So when you hear statistics about the offense possibility, so big deal if the guy does come back and steal something. But it is quite a big deal, even if the recidivism rate is low, when they are reoffend of a sexual nature. And when I come up, when the testifiers come up from the DOC and the BCA, I would like them to go over what we would call a garden variety level two. And what they will probably tell you is that there's really no good description of a level two in the offense category. It could be all over the board because the levels are more a category of how likely they are to reoffend. However, you'll find out, I think, from their testimony that if you are a level two, you're a pretty serious sex offender. To get this classification, you have to be, I believe, in a state correctional institution. And to send them there, it has to be fairly serious. And I just remind you, I asked a question of the person from DOC once before, how come it is that when every single time almost you see one of these headlines in the paper about somebody committed a sexual crime, it lists about three or four, and I think the person told me because that's the media does that. However, just because they don't have a recorded offense on their record, in my experience with sex offenders, this isn't the first time they've done it. This is just the first time they've gotten caught. It's kind of like a guy driving DWI. The statistics say that if you get caught driving while intoxicated, you've probably done it 100 times before. I feel the same way about sex offenders. So whether they're a level one or level two or level three, the only reason I didn't load them all onto the website is, or request that, is I think that might be a stretch right now. The Adam Walsh Act coming up on us federally, I think, is going to require us to put all sex offenders. If you look at another packet, North Dakota, I think, has got a, even though I hate to use the word progressive, policy, they, because it's so misused in so many different ways, is North Dakota has got a policy of letting their residents know who a level two is. In your packet, you'll find it somewhere. I'll find it amongst my papers. I just had it here. And it'll show you pictures and addresses and names. They list about everything on there, and these people are living within a few miles of Moorhead, Minnesota. North Dakota thinks that it's more important to list the sex offender than it is to protect their identity. They're worried more about the protection of their citizens than they are the protection of the sex offender. And we might have a sex offender testify here today or some a friend of a sex offender or a relative or whatever. But you'll have to excuse me if I don't cry a river for the sex offender, because it's a serious issue, and it's not like theft, and it's not like burglary, it's not like any other crime. You talk to the victims or the victim's parents, and you'll see it's totally different. And the recidivism talk and how likely they are to recommit doesn't mean the same thing as in other crimes. Now, I would, with that, I would like, I could take any questions you might have. Otherwise, if you don't have any at this point, I would ask the chairman, which, who wants to testify first?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Cornish, I don't have any disagreement with you or argument with you on the seriousness of a level two sex offender. They are, in fact, very, very serious issues that need to be monitored. So I don't have an issue with that. But I do think we need to pay for that, which any new policies that we put forward. And to that extent, I'd want to know whether we've got a fiscal note that looks at what this is going to cost, first off. And then, secondly, more specifically, who's going to monitor these changes in an offender's address? For example, all these level twos, because there's hundreds of them. Who's gonna do the monitoring? Who's gonna keep track of the addresses? Who's gonna make sure it gets to the website? I mean, someone has to do this, and someone has to. There's got to be a cost associated with it. And if we're gonna do something that this significant, again, there has to be a way to pay for it. So that's my question comment.
Chairman Cornish,
Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson, we have ordered the fiscal note. We haven't got the final yet. Not sure how the final one come out. It could be costly, and a lot of that depends on the agency. I think we all know fiscal notes here. If an agency doesn't want to do something, they can jack the note up, or if it's really popular and they want to do it, they can lower it. So I have a lot of real big faith in fiscal notes. They get pretty close, but sometimes there's some emotion or worry in the fiscal note. So we'll take a close look. That this is going to go to judiciary and, I believe, civil law, and we'll look at those facts. But that's a big concern of mine, too. Really, I'd just love to find the money, put everybody on the website, and just pay for it. But I have to also naturally be cognizant of there might not be enough money to do this or that. One thing I would like you to ask, or some member to ask, when they come up, I've got an idea that's formulating right now, and I haven't put it into amendment form. I'd just as soon take the registration away from the DOC, put it with DCA, and let them do the whole thing that they do the non-compliant offenders now, and have it all done in one location, and move the funding and personnel there if they didn't think that they could handle it. But that's off in the future. Right now, I have to worry about the DOC. I think today might be somewhat prepared to tell you how many man hours it takes to monitor this website, and if we put level twos on, I'm sure they'll have a fairly close opinion to give you an estimate of the FTEs or time involved. And I also want to ask that question of the BCA. And I have to be naturally careful, because they don't know if they can take on this load if you haven't formally asked them through the chain. But I would like to know the comparison in the number of hours and FTEs, how the information that they keep track of differs, and why the DOC needs so many people to operate and the BCA doesn't in comparison. So I want to ask those questions and find that out, too. That's kind of a long answer. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr.
Chair,
just a follow-up question, Representative Johnson.
And again, one of my concerns, in as much as many of these level two offenders, we might be in the metropolitan area, and community corrections does a lot of the supervision and following of these sex offenders, would be the unfunded mandate to our local governments. And I'll look forward to seeing that fiscal note just to ensure that, that's not a problem.
So Chairman Cornish, any?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chairman, President Johnson, it's a good question, and we'll find out about the monitoring. Naturally, I'm just talking about putting it on the website. As far as personally monitoring or intensively on the field, I don't know, but at least the status change in monitoring that, as far as the website's concerned.
Mr. Carger, anything to add on the fiscal note question?
Mr. Chair, we do have a preliminary fiscal note from the Department of Corrections. and they're estimating 4 full-time equivalents plus some data modify existing software with a cost of around $220,000 a year. And they said also the impact on the local corrections is unknown but may be significant. And like I said, it's a preliminary note. It has not been really signed off yet by the executive budget officer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carter. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, is there a definition that exists anywhere of a level 2 sex offender, or can you tell us how that designation is arrived at?
Chairman Cornish.
Representative Hilty, no. We were talking about that before, and that's one of the reasons I've got the testifiers here today, is that it's my understanding, and they're experts in this, that it hasn't to do so much with the crime they've committed. It's the likelihood of their offense. Somewhat it relates to the crime, because you have to commit a certain level of crime or a certain level of punishment to get on the list, but it's not completely indicative of whether you're level 1, 2, or 3. But Mr. Dedan, Eric Knutson, I believe, can give a more accurate description of that. I mean, you can't just say a person that raped a child is automatically a level 2 or a level 3. It could be either one. What I'm trying to say, it depends on the committee that rates that and puts it on the website. So.
Follow-up, Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, part of my question was, who makes that determination? How is that made?
Chairman Cornish?
I think that when Mr. Dene comes up, he can tell you about the committee. I think he's one of the members of the committee, and exactly how that determination is made as to what level they are. I can't remember how many people are on the CER, CRC, or something like that. They'll tell you when they get up.
Thank you. Representative Mallory.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess Mr. Real Chair, whatever. How are we're sending these bills that have fiscal impact, and then we're sending them to Chairman Smith and maybe someplace else. I assume he's not going to eat them, all the costs for your agencies. How is that going to work out? I mean, if we're sending something to him, I imagine he's not going to take DOC costs out of his budget. Are they going to be sent back here then again, or how is that going to work?
Chairman Cornish?
Well, in general, I think the bills will eventually rise and fall on their own merits, both the fiscal and policy, and they could be sent back. Determined is yet to be made. Once we get the final fiscal note, then we'll really start fine-tuning and asking more questions, see if we agree with it. And naturally, it's something that's out of this limit that we can't afford. We can't find the money. It would be hard to justify. But as you know, in previous experience here in your tenure, that sometimes fiscal notes are absorbed, sometimes they're just ignored and waived, and they find the money somehow, or sometimes the bill ends up dying for lack of being able to pay for it. So it could be any one of number of fates that this bill meets. So naturally, I hope that that they've exaggerated the fiscal note in the end, and it is lowered, and we find some way to pay for it. So, but that determination will be made in this committee and the Judiciary Committee in the future.
Representative Maury?
So I guess what you're saying is it could end up back here if there's a significant fiscal for DOC or whatever, it would end up back here. It wouldn't be over. Okay.
It could.
Chairman Maury?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. I believe Director Dene is scheduled to testify. And can you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning. My name is Bill Dene. I am with the Department of Corrections, and my position is Director of the Risk Assessment Community Notification Unit. What we do in that unit, very, very briefly, is we essentially run 3 production lines. One line is the line that does the screening for civil commitment review. Another line is the line where we get risk levels assigned to offenders before they leave the prison. And the third line is the community notification line. And in the civil commitment line, we review approximately 700 to 800 files per year.
the assigning of risk levels. We assign between 800 to 900 risk levels a year. And in the community notification side, we do approximately 83 to 8,500 address changes per year. So that's basically an overview of what our unit does. In terms of House File 151, the Department of Corrections doesn't take a position on it. This morning I'm here to give you information. And perhaps in the opinion of Chairman Cornish Baloney. But I'll start with a very, it's basically just minimal background on the sex offender population, how we assign risk levels, how risk levels are used, and also talk somewhat about the tasks that we see would be associated with implementing House File 151. Before I go into that, I'd like to remind myself of what the nature of my job is, and I think we would all agree that our purpose here is to improve public safety. And I use that term a lot in my work, and I use these types of things to remind myself what we mean by public safety. And to me, what we mean, and I think we would all agree, is the job is to reduce the probability that these amazing people like this have a reduced risk of being assaulted and experiencing sexual violence. And I get to this screen, I always have a hard time going off of it because it's the nicest screen in my presentation. But basically, as Chairman Cornish mentioned, responsibilities are split in terms of managing sex offenders. The BCA does the registration, DOC assigns risk levels. Local law enforcement does the community notification. And in terms of supervision, depending upon the county, the state DOC supervises sex offenders in some counties, and in other counties, county corrections supervises the sex offenders. When I'm talking about sex offender management, there's some very general or broad statistics that seem to be confirmed in repeating research in Minnesota as well as across the country. And I refer to them as the 390s and the 2Rs. And very briefly, is the 190 is that 90% of sex offenders do not reoffend, or at least they're not reconvicted of a sex offense following 10 years from their release from prison. 90% of sex offenders know the victim knows the offender. In other words, the offender is a family member, a relative, an acquaintance, someone in the neighborhood, or someone, a professional in the victim's life, such as a teacher, a minister, that sort of thing. The other 90, which is always informative to me, is that 90% of the sex offense convictions that occur in Minnesota are committed by an individual who has no prior sex offense conviction, which means, although I spent most of my professional life working on reducing recidivism, the fact is, when we eliminate recidivism 100%, 90% of the sex offense convictions will still occur. So when you're thinking about distributing resources, that's one of the things to think about in terms of how do we reduce sexual violence in Minnesota, is if we reduce recidivism, we've got 10% of the problem dealt with. As far as about its relationship, it's not the residents. That has to do with sometimes people feel that it's beneficial to implement residential restrictions with sex offenders. We did a study in Minnesota, looked at 224 sexual reoffenses, and determined that in none of those cases would a residence restriction have prevented the sexual reoffense. So that's very briefly the 390s and the 2Rs. And I refer to it frequently.
We have a question from Representative Johnson. I want to get to you before we go too far.
Just briefly, when you're referring to these numbers, are you referring to all convicted sex offenders that went to prison? Are you talking about other sex offenders who went to county jails as well, or just on probation? What category are you talking about here?
Dr. Dene.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what was the statistic you're asking about? Which?
Were you speaking about the 390s specifically, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would be those released from prison, sex offenders released from prison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you please go back again? And I'm not understanding. 90% of sex offenders are committed by non-sex offenders.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I'm referring to there is 90% of the sex offense convictions in Minnesota are committed by individuals who have no prior sex offense conviction. In other words, they're first-time offenders.
So
first-time sex offenders.
And they could be a relative or a pastor or whatever.
The point I'm trying to get to is recidivism is 10% of the sexual violence in Minnesota. Mm. Not to minimize the severity and the importance of recidivism, I'm just saying when we're talking about sexual violence across Minnesota, recidivism is 10% of the problem.
Representative Moran. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Jay. With that 10% recidivism, is that more likely to be a level 3 versus a level 1? How does that break out?
Mr. Chair, Director. Representative, I have a slide about that, but...
Okay. One more question for you, Director Dene. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I guess I appreciate the questions because at some point, when you talk about recidivism, at the worst of the worst, we've known that they cannot, that they will reoffend. We've not been able to let any out that hasn't reoffend. So at some point, we've been able to come to that specific level that we know they're not going to, or it gets down to a 10% rate. How have we determined that?
Director Dene.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not quite sure what the question is, but I think what we do in terms of we have a very a sex offender management system in Minnesota that includes lots of elements such as registration, community notification, DNA, enhanced supervision, enhanced sentencing, and all of those are focused on reducing recidivism. So what we try to do is we try to, based upon risk assessment, focus the resources on the most high risk that we know it to be the most high risk. Is that,
Mr. Kelly? I
appreciate it. I apologize. Let me clarify. I guess if we call them the worst of the worst, there's basically a 100% recidivism rate. We know that if we let these people out, they will reoffend.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would not say that we know that they're 100% likely to reoffend. But what we do is we use a actuarial risk assessment instrument, which is developed through empirical research, and we identify factors that are related to reoffending. And a certain score places an individual in a category that we know of that category to have reoffended at a certain rate. So a certain score may say this person has the characteristics of a group of people, and of that group of people, about 60% reoffended. So we can't really say that this individual has a 60% chance of reoffending, but we can say he's in a category of people of those 60% reoffended. And I don't know of any score that would say all of these people have a 100% chance of reoffending.
Mr. Chair, I apologize, and this is it. I won't belabor it. But the fact is that we have put people away, and to my knowledge, we've released one person, and they reoffended. And I'm talking about the highest level of sex offenders. Okay, so that's 100% recidivism rate in my mind. Okay, so now at some point we've gone down to level 1, 2, and 3, and your numbers were using 90% and that 10% recidivism rate. Somewhere we've determined that it's just this group we're talking about, and we haven't moved up to the levels. So I guess maybe it goes along with the questions that we already heard. Where is that breakoff point? Is it 1? Is it 2? Is it 3? And I think the question's been asked. So it's just that 90% do not sexually reoffend. It just seems like a kind of a vague statement there. And I guess it's trying to get down to the data and how we made those cutoffs. But let's continue. I won't belabor it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're absolutely right, Representative. It is a very generalized statement. Basically because the issue of sex offender recidivism it really gets pretty complex when you get into it. My intent here, due to the time limitation, is to give a very broad background. Thank you. I have to excuse myself just a moment. I need to get my water.
Okay. Sure. Continue when you're ready, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Who gets a risk level? The biggest group of people who get a risk level are those who are required to register and are being released from prison. We also assign risk levels to offenders coming to Minnesota from another state, as well as offenders coming to us from the federal system. The statute that governs risk level assignment is 244.052, and we are required by that statute to assign risk levels on a case-by-case basis. We have three risk levels, 1, 2, and 3, and you have handouts there in regards to them. I think the significant thing to think about is in terms of the current legislation indicates that level 2 is the level of notification is again determined by local law enforcement, but it's focused on informing those groups of people who may be most likely to be offended against by the offender. Most often this applies to daycares and schools and that sort of thing. Whereas level 3s get a very broad community notification, and including in often cases a community meeting as well as publication on a website, and local law enforcement may as well do other things as well, such as mailings, media releases, and that sort of thing. Just some very brief overview of the numbers involved. In 2010, we assigned 860 risk levels. As you can see, 277 of those risk levels were risk level 2. In all, we have, as of January 1st, individuals who have an active risk level, 6,900 approximately, about 1,780 are level 2s. When we talk about putting level 2s on the website, not all of those 1,780 would go on the website because a significant portion of them are either incarcerated, either have returned for a release violation, a few for a new offense, and some have not been released yet. Also, quite a few of these have been civilly committed to the Department of Human Services. So the people that go on the website are those that are living in the community. And so in that case, we end up about 1,100 to 1,200 level 2s would go on the website. Of course, you start talking about those kind of numbers, those kinds of resources. The question is, does it work? Does community notification have an impact on recidivism? Does it enhance public safety? We in Minnesota Department of Corrections, through our research unit, did one study on this. It's a very difficult issue to study because it's hard to get concrete, absolute bodies of people at a certain time in order to compare those who were subject to notification and those who were not. But this, you can, the link to this study is on our website if you want to look at it in more detail. What we found was it appears as though the level 3 broad community notification did have an impact on sexual recidivism, and it seems as though it did reduce sexual recidivism among the level 3s. You'll see by the statistics here is the level 3s in this study reoffended at the same rate as the level 1s, whereas the level 2s were reoffending at about a 2.5% higher rate. The thing about that study is we're not sure what part of broad notification impacted that recidivism. As I mentioned, there's other parts of broad notification.
Dr. Dene, Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That study did it. How would you factor out the fact that you put much more in, talking to the probation officers that work on this, there's a different level of everything, treatment, much more intensive supervision,
Mr.
So how would you say it's due to the community notification as opposed to now we're sometimes using bracelets, we're using lie detector tests. I know I had the bill in for that. Just we're even using the AA type models now that have worked around the country. How can you,
Mr. Chair, Representative,
factor out
this study was authored primarily by Dr. Grant Dewey, and I've asked him that same question, and he said, well, Bill, it's statistically controlled for it. And I said, well, Dr. Dewey, what do you mean by that? And he spent about a half hour explaining that to me, and that's about the extent of my answer I can give you is it's statistically controlled for. Some of the qualifiers to the study, though, indicate that he could not take into account sex offender treatment because there wasn't sufficient data on that issue. And there were some level 3s were not examined because they've had multiple risk levels in their history. And I said sex offender treatment was not addressed. And that is an interesting question, is because when an individual is assigned a risk level 3, the whole system responds to that designation. in terms of supervision, in terms of law enforcement, in terms of responding to misbehavior, et cetera. As like I said, Dr. Dewey says he thinks he's controlled for that, and the reason for the decreased recidivism in the level threes is the broad notification. That's the best I can tell you. Like I say, the study is posted and obviously open to anybody's.
Any follow-up, Representative Moore?
Yes. Is that, in the scientific community, there's such a thing as peer review. Is that nationally recognized through peer reviews, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it was peer reviewed. It was in the Journal of Criminal Justice.
Okay.
We took a look at other studies across the country in terms of, and it's this whole business of registration and notification. Some states don't separate the two. If somebody's registered, he is on a website, so it's kind of difficult to get a hold of this issue, but there's quite a few studies have indicated that when an individual is put on a website, he does suffer negative consequences. I'm not saying that as an advocate for sex offenders. It's just it's related to the stabilization and the success of his or her transition. And, of course, as we're all looking at reduced recidivism. The more successful offenders we have in the community, the better off we are. But also there's studies, of course, that indicate that communities in general, citizens in general, support the notion of websites, and they appreciate having websites. Then they report feeling more safe in their communities and that sort of thing, and they indicate appreciation that they have that site available to them. A couple sites took a look, studies took a look at, okay, so the website is available, how often do you look at it? Oftentimes, even though they appreciate it, not that significant number have looked at the website. Another study looked at, you have the community notification. What do you do in terms of your behavior? Do you change your behavior? In most cases, no, they didn't change their behavior. So it's... But there's no ambiguity in the fact that when they poll the citizens, it's the majority are in favor of public websites. In terms of impact on recidivism, it seems as though there's quite a bit of data accumulating that indicates that registration in itself reduces recidivism. Not the public notification, but registration and several studies and recidivism rates being decreased from 1% to 12% in those studies. When it comes to notification, the findings are a little less ambiguous. One study, some studies find no difference. Of course, our study found a decrease. A couple other studies have found a decrease in recidivism due to the notification. Another study contradicts it and found an increase in recidivism. So when it registration, it seems as though the data is showing more and more that it does reduce recidivism. Notification, probably the jury is still out. One interesting study, just for information, is found that registration decreased recidivism and public notification decreased first-time offenses, but increased recidivism. Noodle that one out a little bit, but the authors there suggested that the extra stress put on those on the website increased recidivism, but the general public was so concerned about being placed on a website that they decreased their sexual assault of behavior. I know that I'm short on time here, so I'm going to keep moving. This is some more of that baloney that Chairman Cornish was mentioning. And I don't always disagree with him, but sometimes I do. I mentioned our sex offender risk management system. This is basically the system we have in operation. And as you notice there under registration, that's operated by BCA. And as Chairman Cornish mentioned, they also operate a website for non-compliant offenders. This is a graphical display of three-year sexual recidivism. What it looks at is offenders released between 1990 and 2002, and it looks at their reoffense rates as of 3 years after their release. And you look those released in 1990, their three-year recidivism rate was somewhere around 19 to 20%. whereas those released in 2002, by 2005, their reoffense rate was somewhere around 4 or 5%. So, again, I'm not saying that essentially this demonstrates or shows that the rate of conviction has declined. Now, you know, recognizing Chairman Cornish's concern that even though they may not be convicted, they may, you know, they may still be sexually offending. Obviously, there could well be some truth to that. But what this demonstrates is that in terms of those that we catch reoffending, the numbers we catch has gone down in this period of time, which points to me that the system seems to be working in terms of sexual reconviction. Is I'm not sure what part of the system is, but the reoffense rates continue to decline. This talks about what we think the kinds of things it takes to run a website, and we run the level 3 website. As of the numbers on that website change on a daily basis, sometimes hourly. The last I looked, it was 210 level 3s, and we estimate it takes about one full-time person to keep that website accurate. And the kinds of things that seems, you know, it would be nice if we could say, yeah, we can flip a switch and we'll migrate the data from this database over to the website and it won't take much work at all. Unfortunately, you got to realize we're tracking human beings here. And we're tracking human beings who have a history of instability in terms of employment, particularly residents, and as well as their behavior. And so it takes quite a bit of work to keep this website accurate. And I want to emphasize accuracy is, it seems to me accuracy is a very critical element, is because variety of scenarios can come to mind. One that really concerns me is a few years ago in Massachusetts, an individual took a look at their website and went and murdered two of the offenders who were listed on that website. There have been other instances of harassment. There was another murder of a person on a website in one of the western states. And I'm not, again, I mean, that's a horrible thing to happen, but the what would make that situation even more difficult to deal with is what if those individuals had been listed incorrectly on the website? And what if the individuals who had been in the residence where they were listed to be had been not people with no criminal history, and they had been murdered because they were, that address was listed on the website as the residence of a criminal. Those are the kinds of things that worry me about the accuracy of websites. But also, you also think about if you have a neighborhood where our website says there is no sex offender in your neighborhood when in fact there is, and another neighborhood we're saying there is a sex offender there when in fact there is not. From my position of being providing a service from the state, I just have this strong feeling that the website needs to be accurate. And so these kinds of things we run into is, before we put an individual on a website with an address, we want that address verified, and so that rests upon a local law enforcement to verify that individual is indeed living at that address. The other thing is we have to manually enter the information into the database, which of course takes resources. We, on our level 3 site, excuse me.
Director Denae, I'm going to, pardon me for a minute. Representative Grunhagen has a question for you.
Mr. Chair, Director Denae, you know, on the examples that you've given about things that can happen, you know, wrong address, has any of that happened where a level 3 offender who's been posted on the website and let's say it was done incorrectly, have any of those negative things happened at the level 3 level of posting?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no sir, it hasn't.
Okay, so none of those have happened with any, none of those, if the errors did occur at a level 3 level posting, the consequences you listed off did not have not happened.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what happens is we get telephone calls from people in the community telling us, you've got so-and-so on the website at so-and-so address. He doesn't live there. And so we say, well, what do you know about that? And so they tell us, well, I don't know, he doesn't live there. Or they tell us, well, he lives over on a different street. Our question then, of course, to us is, well, we can't change the website based upon a phone call. So our question, who's really calling and why are they calling? So we call local law enforcement. And, of course, they have to decide whether or not they're going to proceed with an investigation or not. So these are the kind of cases we end up tracking them for a long time sometimes, because oftentimes law enforcement doesn't have the resources or they don't prioritize accurate addresses. And so we have a certain number of cases that we know the address is questionable, and we're trying to get resolution to it. And sometimes it involves more than one law enforcement. It may be the law enforcement where we have him reported to be residing, and we may have information he lives in a different law enforcement jurisdiction. So now we're working with two law enforcement. So this is how you get involved, the staff time involved in this. And as I mentioned, we have these three production lines running, and we can't stop the production lines to deal with these kind of situations. And so we need to have staff who can step off the production line and take care of these unique cases that go on. As I said, we have about 210 level threes. Now we're talking about another 1,200 level twos. So it gives you an idea of where the resources begin to be needed.
Director Dene, we want to make sure we have plenty of time for our friends at the ACLU as well to be able to testify. Are there any additional questions? Representative Moran?
Let me just say this before I even ask a question, because as a mother, as a woman, as a sister, as an aunt, you know, this is offense that is really heinous, and so I don't want to have my questions seen as I'm defending or whatever a sex offender, because it's not. It's just a concern, and I too also believe that part of safety, public safety, is to allowing those to re-enter society to be upstanding citizens and go on with their life. Because what I heard from you is say that 90% of sex offenders are non-sex offenders. So I guess one of my questions is, and it could be my brother, my uncle, it could be my pastor, and it's more likely that they would not reoffend. I think that's what I heard. But one of my questions is, do you have any number two sex offenders who are younger than 18?
Director Dene?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not assign risk levels to those who have a only offense is a juvenile offense. So in answer to your question, no.
Okay, good.
Moran, follow up.
And so my second question is, gosh, I lost my thoughts on that one. Can I come back to it?
We can come back to you. Representative Johnson.
thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the point of, is it Dene, is how you pronounce your name? Notion of supervision of change of address. I know, having worked in the supervision in this field for a while, that level threes move around and about quite a bit. And I suspect that's going to be the case with level twos, and as their pictures and names and address are put on a website, that might increase the likelihood of difficulty in housing and jobs and so forth, and again increase the likelihood of moving. So I guess my point is that the verification, the accuracy of the system is very important. It's going to take a lot of time and effort to ensure that we have accurate information on this website. We're dealing with a very mobile group of people that are addressed in this particular bill.
Dr. Dene?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's always amazing to me if you walk through my unit, we have 20 staff people, and six are doing community notification. And if you walk through the unit, you'll see they are always on the phone or on email, trying to communicate with law enforcement, trying to communicate with agents, trying to verify where is this guy living today. Because that's our primary effort a significant effort is to keep that level three site accurate.
Okay, follow up, Reverend.
And just follow up, and again, I'm not against any means that going forward on this, but if we do, we need to pay for it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Chairman Cornyn.
We still got BCA and ACLU, and if you don't want to run over in
which
your
I do not,
hour, we got to get going.
Okay. let's call Eric Knutson from the BCA. Thank you, Director Dene.
While he's coming up, I want Mr. Dene to know when I used the term baloney, I wasn't talking about his statistics. It's just how they come about when you say no previous sex offenses. It's according to no convictions on record, and asking the offender, yeah, have you had any convictions before? No. Or any offenses? So that's the only part I meant.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Knudsen, could you...
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Eric Knudsen, a special agent charged of our Crimes Against Persons section at the BCA, and I also wanted to reiterate my thanks for you taking your time out of your busy schedule on Tuesday to come and take a tour of our unit. Much appreciated, so thank you. I also want to have one point of clarification, I think, for Representative Kelly. On your question, I believe you're referring to civilly committed offenders. which is a completely different population than the Department of Corrections offenders that are assigned risk levels. So when you're talking about you've had the one person who's reoffended and is back incarcerated again, those would be individuals who are currently confined in the MSOP programs in St. Peter and Moose Lake. So I think there's a little bit of confusion there about who those offenders are. The ones you are referring to are the civilly committed predatory offenders. Does that make sense?
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, yes, it certainly makes sense. My point being that there are different levels, even though we don't, that the different civilly committed is different. There's different levels of sexual offenses. So somewhere with the data, we've decided that we can include 1, 2, and 3, but we don't include after that or those civilly committed. So the data is skewed, in my opinion, to when we say the recidivism rate. So that was my point. And somehow we've been able to establish what that cutoff point is when we're using a 10% recidivism rate. That's all my point was.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to have that point of clarification.
Okay. Just had a quick question for you about the technical ability of the BCA. If the legislature decided to transfer over the Level 3 website as well as add to Level 2, does the BCA have the technical capability? We won't get into the financial piece of it today, but the technical ability to do something like that?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I believe the BCA would have the technical ability to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Moran. Representative Mariani.
Pretty close, right?
Yeah. I got the M's right.
And even the same Senate district.
And I serve on three committees with you. You'd think I'd get it.
we'll get it. We'll get it together.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate the Chair's expression that you don't want to get into finance issues, but we are a finance committee. And so it seems to me a very quick question about the PCA in terms of are there relative to that concept, would you anticipate or expect that there could be finance issues that this raises for the BCA in terms of the need for more finances, for instance, or the need for less?
Mr. Knuth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I just want to give a little perspective on the current public website that we administer, which is the non-compliant website for the BCA. We currently have about nearly 800 non-compliant offenders listed on the public website. We have approximately 2 full-time staff that administer that website. So in answer to your question, Representative, yes, we would need additional resource if we were to add on additional websites or additional offenders.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Knudsen. You are dismissed.
Thank you.
Anyone else in support of the bill? Okay, I would like to call Teresa Nelson from the ACLU. Could you please state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal counsel for the ACLU of Minnesota. We're the statewide affiliate of the National American Civil Liberties Union with about 8,500 members here in the state of Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here today to talk about this issue. The ACLU recognizes the great pain and suffering that is caused by sex offenses and child sexual abuse. Sex offenses should be reasonably investigated, and they should be punished when an individual is convicted and those offenses are identified. However, we believe that now more than ever, it's critical to make criminal justice policy decisions that are based upon facts, sound scientific research, and empirical evidence. Our policy decisions must also take into account the rights of both the complainant and the offender. We believe that House File 151 implicates the constitutional right to be free from ex post facto punishments. While the U.S. Supreme Court has generally upheld the constitutionality of community notification statutes, a number of state Supreme Courts have found that they violate their state constitutions. And I'll give you an example. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Doe versus Smith, upheld Alaska's community notification statute, said that it wasn't an ex post facto punishment, it's constitutional. A few years later, the Alaska Supreme Court looked at the statute in a case called Doe versus State of Alaska, and in that case, the Alaska Supreme Court found that it was indeed an unconstitutional punishment that violated the Alaska Constitution. One of the most important issues that the court looked at in deciding whether or not this scheme was punishment was whether or not the decision is based on the risk level versus some other criteria. And in Alaska, the decisions about community notification are based on the offenses they commit rather than the risk level of the offender. So the another factor that the court noted in deciding that internet postings were unconstitutional punishment in the under Alaska's constitution is that it exposes registrants through aggressive public notification of their crimes to profound humiliation and community-wide ostracism, and that the practical effect of internet dissemination is that it leaves open the possibility that the registrant will be denied employment and housing opportunities. And so looking at that effect, they found that this was a punishment. And of course, punishment can only be imposed as part of your sentencing, not retroactively on somebody who this provision didn't apply to when they committed their crime. And so the court found it unconstitutional. Unlike Alaska's law, Minnesota's current law, as you've seen, really does base community notification on risk. Level 3 offenders who are the most likely to reoffend are subject to widespread community notification, including internet posting. What House File 151 would do is collapse those risks and essentially eliminate the whole purpose of deciding those risk levels and would require internet dissemination for almost for a large variety of offenders, regardless of the moderate risk that they pose to reoffend. So in essence, it makes it more like Alaska's law and more likely to be challenged as an ex post facto punishment. House File 151 also doesn't do a lot to enhance public safety. As the previous the DOC witness testified, community notification is really aimed at reducing recidivism, but recidivism is just a small piece of the pie. A number of studies have shown that the recidivism rate is quite low and is actually even some studies, including a DOJ study from 2000, found that the recidivism rate is actually lower for sex offenders than other offenders. So there's a lot of studies out there. It's complicated, I agree, but the bottom line is that recidivism is really a small chunk of the problem.
Ms. Nelson, excuse me, we have a question from Representative Gauthier.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Nelson, currently under, is there a case pending the Minnesota Supreme Court?
Ms. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not aware of a current case that's pending in the Minnesota Supreme Court.
And so when you talk about collapse and comparing it to Alaskan law, you're making a supposition?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am making a supposition because I'm saying that if we collapse these two categories and have broad, widespread internet notification on both of them, it brings our law, it makes our law riskier and more susceptible to challenge.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
You talk about punishment where others would talk about consequences, natural consequences of behavior. How do you distinguish the difference there?
Mr. Chair, Nelson. Representative. When a court analyzes constitutional issues, what we're talking about is retroactive application of a statute on an individual. And so the court needs to look at whether or not that retroactive application is punitive versus civil. If it's punitive, you can't do it because it's an after-the-fact punishment, and the Constitution prohibits that. Now, if we're talking about applying this only to offenders going forward, people with convictions after the date of enactment, the ex post facto issue is not there. I'm talking about there's thousands of offenders that this might affect who have committed their crimes before this went into effect. And so what I'm talking about when I talk about punishment is the court's analysis of whether or not retroactive application of this law violates constitutional rights.
Mr.
Chairman.
Just a reminder, we are almost at the 12 o'clock hour.
Chairman Cornish, is this retroactive?
Chairman Cornish?
Is your bill say retroactive?
Right.
Let's refer that to Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it is. As a civil consequence of the their prior actions, it can be retroactive.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Ms. Nelson, how about 60 seconds?
All right, Mr. Chair. I think
The bottom line is that this is risky and really only gets at a small number of offenders. It actually will serve to diminish public safety by creating a false sense of security in the eyes of the public. They might know they might think, oh, everybody on this list is who I have to watch out for, when really the risk could be much closer to home. And so we respectfully urge you to oppose House File 151. But I do hope that this isn't the end of the discussion. We believe that this is a multifaceted issue that deserves a multifaceted response. And the focus on recidivism, while it's often at great cost to civil liberties, we should expand the focus on addressing the root causes of childhood sexual abuse and sexual offenses, rather than simply focusing on this small piece of the pie of recidivism. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Nelson. Chairman Cornish, would you like to renew your motion to move House File 151 and re-refer it to the Civil Law Committee?
Yes, I would. Before I do that, I want to say, committee members, here's the bottom line. Most of you are parents or grandparents. And I will sensationalize for a little bit. Level 1, 2, or 3, if I wanted to take the time to take off my shirt and show you a large scar in my arm and tell you about a level 1 sex offender that cut me, that stole a handgun out of my house, and it adds insult to injury, my flag off the flagpole on the way out of my driveway. And we had to go in a search warrant and get it later. Just because they're level 1 doesn't mean they're not capable of bad things. Level 2 have committed pretty nasty crimes. And if you're a parent or a grandparent, you got your kid down in the curb waiting for the bus, I would want to know if there was a level 2 sex offender down the block. And that's the crux of this bill. It's not rocket scientists. We're added level 2 that have created nasty crimes onto the website so we can see who they are. We're not painting circles on their houses or doing anything like this. We just want to know where they are so we can feel safer and, I think, help out public safety. So.
Well, you spurred a question from Representative Smith. So, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Actually, it's not a question. The audio record may reflect that the author of the bill, Representative Johnson, if you'll listen, initially wanted to move it to judiciary first. I've requested that it be sent to civil law. That's a policy committee. I'm taking all steps necessary to ensure that when a bill gets to judiciary, policy, and finance, there's a final fiscal note, or at the very bottom line, a preliminary fiscal note. Just thought you should know.
Okay, with back that, to Chairman Cornish.
Mr. Chair, with that, I'll renew my motion. House File 151 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay, Chairman Cornish moves that we renew the motion to move House File 151 as amended and re-refer that to the Civil Law Committee on a voice vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
The ayes have it, and the motion carries. And we are adjourned.